thank you everyone for joining us today, and thank you, Christine, for the setting the tone for this discussion. Katie and I both are co-founders of Women in Global Health, and this idea was started earlier this spring, so we're very excited to have this be the first panel where we're beginning this exciting, critical discussion on bringing the gender lens to global health leadership. And so Katie's going to talk a little bit more about how we actually began, and I'll talk a little bit more about the movement, and really much more about the initiative that's going to be upcoming this November.
Yeah, so as Rupa mentioned, and as you can see up here, this is the four of us co-founders, and each of us had our own global health path, and we all had these struggles that we had couldn't see the female leadership in our own worlds and all the panels we attended. And so with the advent of the WGH 300 campaign that was started by Ilona Kikwush, we all connected and we all saw an opportunity to bring a greater voice to this issue. We actually all connected through Twitter. So everyone that doesn't think Twitter works, here's your proof. And we see a bigger need for to address gender equity. The environment couldn't be more conducive right now with the release of the SDGs, specifically goal number 5 that calls for achieving greater gender equity. And additionally, the global health sector has always been a leader in its field. We bring all other sectors and partners together, and we have the opportunity to take the global health community and do more and set an example for the rest of the world about how to achieve a gender equitable world.
Great. And building upon that, particularly in the global health world, specifically, we have over 75% of the health workforce represented by women. And however, so many different avenues still demonstrate to us that there is a gender inequity. A great example is when we went to the World Health Assembly this year, we counted the chief delegates, which are basically the delegates that are the head of the delegations to the World Health Assembly, which is the event that the World Health Organization hosts. And we asked everyone, you know, what are your thoughts on what the representation is? We counted the numbers, and what we noticed is not only were there only 23% of the chief delegates headed by women, but there was also a really interesting pattern on how people responded. So those people that have been in global health field for much longer than 10 years were more likely to estimate a lower number, 5 to 10%, whereas people that were new to the global health field were estimating numbers of 40%. And the men we asked were actually on point, guessing 20 to 25%. And so we realized that there was a lot more to this conversation and that we needed to start dissecting the layers of gender inequity in the global health leadership. So another demonstration of this is we're not showcasing the conference name, but this is one of the events that just happened this past fall, and it's one of the largest global health events in Europe. And when we look at the conference participation, which is where many people go for identifying visible leadership and recognizing leaders in the global health field, looking at the speakers and moderators and as well as keynote speakers, there were 31% speakers that were women, moderators were only 21%, and keynote 28%. And if we kind of step back a bit and look at the people that are organizing some of these events, all the presidents, factoring in the scientific committee, the ambassadors, and the actual funding founding committee, there's only one woman represented in that entire group, and that's like over 40 people. So this is just one conference, and we wanted to showcase that there is a challenge in our community and a problem that we want to address, but we see this as an opportunity. Initially, when we started identifying this, we decided that we would create a movement called Women in Global Health, and the movement has a broad scope of bringing the gender equity lens into global health leadership. It is a independent global movement striving to bring actors to take on this dialogue and action in their own communities and platform. And shortly after starting the movement, we were very fortunate to meet like-minded partners. Specifically, the Global Health Council has been a great supporter of our work and also values align significantly, and they are taking the lead with launching the Women Leaders in Global Health initiative, which more to come this November 19th, but the main thing with the initiative is that it focuses on ensuring that we achieve gender equality in leadership and global health, that men and women are equal platforms, and that women are recognized and visible leaders. We focus on three different areas. One area is advocacy, the second area is capacity building, and the third area is mentoring and networking. So that's the strategy priorities we will be using to achieve greater gender equality in global health leadership. So thank you for joining us. So let's get the conversation started. Back to you.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much. So I think all the seats are now taken, so if people do want to sit on the floor and don't mind it, I know I'm wearing pants, so normally I would be sitting on the floor, please do so. There's some room up at the front. The other thing I wanted to mention is we are tweeting, hopefully, this conversation. It's not being a live stream, but we are recording it, so please use the hashtags APHA15 as well as WomenInGH. And if you want to do a little bit of trolling, hashtag all male panel, to maybe show our great representation that we have today. So we've mentioned the SDGs a few times, and we'd like to show a short video to kind of explain a little bit of just where we're coming from with the Millennium Development Goals, where we're going. And this is, I think, a little bit more of a high-energy video with some stats and some storytelling along with it. Was just meant to kind of give the top line messaging around the global goals for sustainable development that were agreed to in September among all world leaders. And if you are hearing about the global goals for the first time, I know this is mostly a domestic conference with a global health track. You can go to globalgoals.org. This video was put together by Richard Curtis and Project Everyone, and he's the one that's produced a lot of the ensemble movies out of the UK, like Four Weddings and a Funeral, so definitely knows how to do production really well, as you can see by this video. And the idea was to really reach a broader audience with the global goals message. So again, wanted to offer this kind of as a frame of where we're going and why it's important that we go there, and to keep it a little bit light as well. So our panel discussion, and we've got this incredible lineup of women to my left, will talk about a few different things. We're going to start out by talking about their own personal story, how they got involved in global health and how they got to where they are today. And I think that what you'll find is that every woman has their own story to tell, their own pathway. I was at Auburn University, graduated with a degree in political science, moved to Washington, never thinking in a million years I would be traveling to developing countries and working in this field. Everyone has a unique perspective. Everyone was helped along the way. So hopefully during the first part of our conversation, you'll hear a little bit about that. And then second, we're going to talk about the SDGs. SDG Global Goal 5 was already mentioned about equity and empowering women and girls. I think it's really important for us to really talk about what that means, not just for how we're going to really achieve our goal to end poverty, but also how we're going to really tackle these issues at every level, so every single sector from community on up to global. And I think each women leader on this panel has a very unique perspective when it comes to that conversation. So to start us out, we're going to go to my left, and Alyssa Smaldino is Executive Director of Global Med. So Alyssa, we're going to start out with just your personal story. I know you're just recently in the workforce. So what would you like to tell the group about just how you got to where you are right now?
Sure. Should I?
Yes, sorry.
Hi, everyone. Well, first, thank you so much for the invitation to be here, Rupa, and I'm really excited to be on a panel with such incredible and powerful women. So by far the most influential thing in my career so far has actually been GlobeMed. I was involved in GlobeMed as a student at George Washington University. I got involved in January 2008. And the way that our model works is that one university partners with one organization for a long period of time to achieve the goals of the organization. And so at George Washington, we were partnered with an organization in Rwanda called the Rwanda Village Concept Project. And I was studying public health, but through that partnership with this organization in Rwanda, I was really able to ground the learning that I was doing in the classroom and real-world experience in the field. So I participated in that partnership as a student for 4 years. Getting to work on site with our partner organization to develop a curriculum related to nutrition education for women who were mothers of the most malnourished children in the community. And so I really got to see the complexities of how health is so multifaceted when it comes to nutrition, agriculture, water, and all the other components of women's health in particular. So I got involved really through the lens of women's health, and specifically maternal health. So that's been incredibly influential. And then after I graduated, I began working full-time for the organization as the first director of partnerships, where I was responsible for finding and supporting all of our partner organizations abroad. So right now we have 56 partnerships and partner organizations, and there are so many people, many really incredible, powerful women who are grassroots leaders who really mentored me and inspired me to get to this point. So that's the basics of my story, but I'm sure I'll elaborate a bit more as the panel goes on.
Thank you. So we're going to work our way down the line. So Isabella Danielle is the Deputy Director of the Pan-American Health Organization, located in Washington, D.C., and responsible for the Americas. So Isabella, the same question to you. What would you like to tell the audience about your own career path?
Thank you very much. It's great to be here and great to see so many women interested in global health. So the first influence on me was my family. My parents are immigrants from Eastern Europe, and so we talked a lot about global issues around the dinner table and about what was happening where they were from and what was going on around the world. That was very important. As well, my father actually was in Auschwitz, so I, as a very young child, had to think about what happened, why did it happen, and how could it be prevented, and that got me into the whole social justice movement. So family is really a critical piece for me. Secondly, I was a teenager in the 1960s and went to school in the 70s, med school as well in the 70s. So the social movements of my youth were really critically important. And I'm talking about the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and most importantly for me, the women's movement. I feel like I was lifted up and carried and cushioned by all of the women that I was working with and who were seeking the same thing that I was and who were thinking about what was going on around them, why things were going on the way they were, how life could be, how it could be better for women, what needed to change, how we were going to change it. So this was really fantastic. So there were always strong women that I was working with who not only questioned how things were, but also stimulated me to think about things and pushed me and challenged me to be more. And this really did have a profound impact. And basically, I'm here, I think, in large part because of that. I started out as an internist. I actually worked at Cook County Hospital, for those of you who are from Chicago. And there was a lot going on there, too. There was a whole social movement at Cook County Hospital. But I felt that first and foremost, back in the 70s, you know, women didn't really feel like they were in control of their bodies, so I got into women's health. Although I'm an internist, I worked on medical complications during pregnancy. And we did feel that it was really critical that not only control over your own body, but the discussions about our body had to be led by women. They could not be led by men. That was just period, exclamation point. So I wanted to contribute to that discourse. And that's kind of led me into the fields of reproductive health and maternal and child health. And again, lots of women went into those fields, so I feel like I was always surrounded and working with lots of great women. But I think it's also important to note that as far as global development and health development within global health, within the whole, you know, movement for development, women have played an incredibly important role. There was the Cairo meeting in 93, I think it was, or 4, on population and health. And women activists basically took over that meeting and said, if you're talking about population, reproduction, these are women's issues. We have to have women's rights. We have to have women's empowerment, or it's just not going to happen. So that was important. And then, of course, there was the Beijing conference. So women have had a very strong voice, I think, in not just global health, but the whole global development movement, and I just wanted to interject that as well. I think the other thing I want to say is that men have played a role in my life as well. There have been many men who have supported and promoted me and helped me with critical thinking and included me in their discussions. I think a lot of that happened because there were women who were raising everybody's consciousness about what needed to be done. So, but I did want to say that, and I think so. Women and men also do play a role. So those are sort of, that's why I'm older than everybody else here, with a few exceptions. But it's great to see that there's organizing going on. I love it. So thank you.
Great. So thank you so much, Isabella. So we're now going to move over to Leticia Rispol, who is Governing Council Member of the World Federation of Public Health Associations, past President, Public Health Association of South Africa. So brings a unique experience through her growth and her movement within academia in South Africa and globally. So Leticia, would you like to share with us how you got to where you are today and what you'd like the audience to know?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I think I'm the only non-American on the panel, so that provides for an interesting perspective. So I always tell people, in a nutshell, there are three things that determined what I was going to do with my life. The first one is that I was born in the wrong decade, under apartheid, which for those of you that are probably too young to remember, that there was a point 21 years ago when South Africa became a democracy, but prior to that suffered from a brutal racialized system, incidentally, which wasn't very different from what black Americans experienced in the 60s. which is quite a recent period, just from a historical perspective. The second aspect is that I was born a girl child. I think if I was male, then my parents would have found a way to send me to university. And the third one was that I was born poor. And so there were very few options open to black women in South Africa. And I was desperate to go to university. So I did a graduate program in nursing, because it meant two things. Firstly, that I could go to university, and secondly, that I didn't, because of the way the funding system works in South Africa, even at that time, I didn't have to depend on anybody to get me through university, because there was a stipend that was paid by the health department to all students who entered university to do a nursing degree, and the numbers were very small in that time. My entry into public health, the job that pays my money, I'm the dean of one of the schools of public health in South Africa, quite a large school of public health. What got me into public health was a combination of being an activist in anti-apartheid health organizations and doing a public health degree where I was introduced to the wonderful subjects of epidemiology and biostatistics, and that really interested me. And it kind of continued an interest that I had in school. I wanted to study science at university. I didn't have a clue of what nursing entailed. But in a way, it really shaped what was to happen in later years. So early on, I specialized in critical care nursing in child health, and it struck me the injustice that here we were spending lots of money on putting children, or small babies, infants sometimes, that weighed 1 kilogram on ventilators, yet there were thousands of children that died because of lack of sanitation, because they didn't have access to vaccination. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what shaped my destiny.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. I think it's really personal, and it really paints a picture for us. Purvi Bhatt is Program Director of Global Access Medtronic Philanthropy. Purvi, the same question for you. Could you talk about your personal story and who might have helped you along the way?
Sure. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I can feel the sink of energy going on here. So I am happy to hopscotch my way through a career of changing jobs, because that's been how I've gotten through Twitter. But much like what we've heard from folks before, my personal journey really began with my family. I am also a daughter of an immigrant from India. My father came over on a boat and a prop plane, and boy, he told that story his entire life, of how hard it was for him to come here. I'm an only child daughter that came up, and when we came to this country, it was very rare to, one, be an only child in an Asian family, and on top of that, make a choice to go into public health rather than go into engineering or university. For me to make that choice took probably more courage than I realized in the moment, and courage from my parents to be able to accept that kind of decision, because at the end of the day, it was their dinner party that they needed to explain that to their peers. And so a lot of my journey was governed by a very courageous father and mother who went through their own path to coming to this country and being leaders in their own right, and then accepting a daughter that was trying to do the same. You know, I heard a quote this morning, I'm just learning about Twitter, I'm also older than most people here, and it was around a study that said that a third of girls that were surveyed recently said that they would not speak up in the presence of boys. That's astonishing to me, but I will say I was that girl. So I understand how that feels. And so it is even more astonishing that I'm speaking today. And I will say that I went through a good bit of school not asking any questions. Where I tripped and finally ended up in the career that I'm in is because I ended up inside of the HIV movement. So I think you're going to hear a common thread of inequalities and something not feeling right and really recognizing that something should make logical sense, but it doesn't. And that starts to eat away at you and you start to respond. And so for me, it was very clear that it was time to get involved in something where very few people would, with parents who really thought I should have been in med school. Who is this girl that is not married and is our only child who is now talking about sex work and condoms and drugs? You know, going into red light districts that they had no idea existed in their very own cities and communities. But to do all of that required something inside that says, I can't rest me. And that is something I think we're all hardwired somehow to do. That's how we ended up here. That's how you all ended up in this room. So my career is really the journey of HIV. I started off in a very traditional public health career, came out of grad school, went into GAO, of all things, tracked HIV policy for them, which is the U.S. General Accountability Office. Ended up at the predecessor GHC, so it's lovely to be sharing a panel with Christine. And then, again, hopscotched through my career, but luckily, and I say luckily, ended up in the private sector, which is where I am today. And I had the opportunity to bounce in and out of the private sector for a variety of industries. I was at Abbott at a time when drug prices were pressured to drop because, again, the HIV movement required it. I was at Levi's because it was time for a company taking on the role of as employer to make sure that their employees were covered so that their diseases would be insured. And today I'm at Medtronic. And I'm at Medtronic not because of HIV, but because of non-communicable diseases. And again, a disease category that has very little attention, clearly huge pressure on the economy. It's clearly the tsunami that's coming. And once again, no one's doing anything. So the voice is needed again. So my career path has been mainly learning how to speak up. And I will say I'm here today because I'm astonished that there's still a third of girls today who need to speak up. And so we have to be here to demonstrate that we're a panel of women that are there for them. They're not seeing a panel that shows them that it makes a difference if they do.
Thank you so much, Praveen. I hope we see a lot of tweets with that stat in it because I think that's really powerful. I would also add that I did as well work for the Global Health Council, so we've got two alumni and one current appointed employee on the panel. So, Christine, we already introduced you, but again, would love for you to comment about your personal journey.
Great, thank you. So I'm the director of Global Health Council, but I actually started out my public health work as an epidemiologist and working on HIV and reproductive health. I think the thing that I've heard across the panel, and I suspect if I ask for a show of hands in the room, is this idea, and you just mentioned it, is the idea around justice and injustice. And I very much got involved in this work because I was passionate about social justice. I will say I was not the girl who didn't speak up. I was the one who spoke up and got kicked out of class because I was being ornery or talking back. I was actually at my sixth grade class reunion a couple of weekends ago, and they were reminding me that I got suspended in sixth grade because I talked back to the teacher. I had to take that energy and learn how to channel it and how to use it. And it has been just incredibly valuable to me as I've gotten older and hopefully more mature to be able to, you know, harness that energy, but also think about how I'm using it in a positive, constructive way. But it's also what's kept me going when I have had people who have told me I wasn't worth anything, who have taken my work and put it off as theirs, who have, you know, really tried to grind me down because I was young, I was a woman, and I was unmarried. I spent most of my career actually in West Africa, and my husband is West African, so I'm American, but I also have a very, very strong roots in Mali, and I learned so much there from my work experience there, but also from my experience with especially the women of Mali. And, you know, I say if I had one superpower tomorrow, it would be to be able to speak to any woman anywhere, because the women in my husband's family don't speak any of the languages that I speak and vice versa, so I can't speak to them directly, and that is something that, you know, I would love to be able to change. But going back to my journey,
I wanted to get involved in politics. I wanted to get involved in community mobilization. I also wanted to see the world, and I realized that I couldn't speak for others. I needed to help others be able to speak for themselves. And for me, what resonated in public health and in healthcare in general was that women are frequently silenced because they are caretakers, because they are channeling their energies and making sure that they and their families are healthy and have food on the table and have shelter over their head and have, if they can, shoes on their feet. And so by working in healthcare, working in public health, it was a way to be able to free up, hopefully, the ability and capacity and potential of women everywhere to be able to mobilize for themselves. So that's how I got here. I've also hopscotched around. I've worked in NGOs, academia, government. I'm in the best job of my life right now, and so I feel very lucky to be here, and I'm very happy to be here. I'll just add the other thing that's been very interesting for me is that, and I don't know about anyone else on the panel, but I am the mother of a teenage girl, and I also have a 20-something, early 20s niece who I'm helping to raise. And it has been very interesting for me. People have talked about their parents, and I have had a really special and growing relationship with my parents, but also to be the mother of girl children and now girl women, and thinking about how we can help their journey along. And even if they don't have the same challenges that we have had, they have other challenges that are all their own and all their generations, and how do we take that and give them the resources that they need to move that forward? It's awesome.
Great. Thank you so much. And actually, Christy, we're going to stay with you as we pivot to the second part of our discussion around the SDGs. And I think that's why where you are right now is so important, leading the Global Health Council. So we've already heard that women make up the vast majority of those working in the field of global health, but they're very underrepresented at institutional organizations, in global policy circles, and on thought leadership panels. Not today, obviously, but we've seen it. So we're going to start with you, Christine, around your work through the Global Health Council. We've already heard a little bit of the new Women Leaders in Global Health initiative to be launched later this month. Why now? Why is it so important that we really focus on gender equity? And is it significant that there is an SDG devoted entirely to gender equity and women and girls empowerment?
Thanks. Why now? I think that we are probably 10 years ago we should have been doing this. It's not something that is just pertinent now. But we are on the cusp between a discussion and a movement and work that we've been doing around the Millennium Development Goals, which were very clear on health. There were 3 Millennium Development Goals on health, and we have now moved from those goals into the Sustainable Development Agenda, which is for 2015 to 2030, 2016 to 2030. We're talking about ending extreme poverty. We're talking about the fact that we can't do this without women being able to fulfill their potential. But we're not seeing this come together in a concrete fashion in terms of networking and building on all of the wealth and resources that we have in this field. What GHC does is we work with our members and we work with the global health community to really bring global health stakeholders together to help build networks, to help make connections, to help facilitate discussions, and to help identify areas that are underrepresented or neglected in global health policy and advocacy space. What we are hoping to do with this initiative is not to do it ourselves. That's not what we're looking at. We're looking at all of the different things that are going on, because we know that there are lots of these conversations going on. We know that there are lots of activities, there are lots of initiatives, there are lots of movements, there are lots of capacity building resources out there, but they're not connecting in a way that is bringing this together to be a cohesive movement. And so what we are hoping to do is help map that, help bring attention to what does exist, help bring attention to the gaps that are out there that we can help fill in. You know, Rupa and Katie had showed us the statistics about the recent conference. I think, you know, if we ask people about are women adequately represented, most people will say yes. And I think that if you brought those statistics to the people who organized that conference, they would probably be shocked that that is actually the case of how it played out. So what we're asking is, how can we push people to be conscientious, to be conscious, to be deliberate, to take strategic actions that can actually be quite small, but that will help raise their awareness and permit them to take actions to actually change the way things are being organized? So in the case of this conference and other conferences, is there a checklist out there? Are organizers saying to their panel, to the panels that they accept, in order to give us a panel, you must show that you consider gender equity? Recently in The Atlantic, there was a very funny article published. Somebody, a statistician, had done an analysis to refute the idea that, oh, but you know, all the best and brightest are men, and so they're the ones on the panel. And so he did this whole thing, and in fact showed that the chances of that were infinitesimally small. So, you know, how can we provide some tools, how can we provide some resources to impressions and a déclic, like to make people notice, sit up and notice that what they're doing isn't okay, that, you know, just doing it from goodwill and not intentionality isn't going to get us to where we need to be. And that's women, that's men. And there are lots of really good meeting men out there. So this is, you know, it is not at all to say that there's some sort of a conflict here. It's much more thinking about let's be deliberate, let's be strategic, and let's be conscientious. Because at the end of the day, if we're going to achieve these goals, we've set a really high bar for ourselves. If we're going to achieve these goals, we need to have the full talent pool represented. We need to be pulling from the best and brightest across the world, not from the best and brightest of one portion of the world. That's all up there. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Christine. I think it's a very nice segue back to Purvi. We've heard a little bit about your work across business, nonprofit, and government. And there's some room in the on the floor up here if you guys want to.
They're actually counting numbers.
Oh, are they?
So we have reached our max, and next time we will have a bigger room.
So we should have started with Girl on Fire instead of Who Runs the World.
Yeah.
Fire exit joke. I guess if you have to explain it, it wasn't funny. So, Purvi, back to you. We heard about your business, nonprofit, and government experience. To achieve the 17 goals, the SDGs, we will definitely need women leaders in all of those sectors. So could you share a little bit of just what you've seen maybe in private sector of how women have become leaders in different institutions of where you've worked? Maybe there was a management program that really was outstanding. Just kind of how were the different kind of private sector entities and organizations where you worked able to recruit and really sustained those type of women leaders? And really, more than that, just really having diversity when it comes to different races as well.
Sure. Well, you can imagine, in a lean in, unfinished business world, I sit inside of a lot of rooms where I am the only woman, the only person of color, certainly the only woman of color. And that's become more prominent recently than in my past. And some of it's because I am, you know, a bit more senior than I was over the years, but I think it's also reflective of what's really going on. And it is, as someone in public health and global health, it's astonishing to me that it took Rupa bringing this to us for us to see what was going on in our own world, at least to me. And so it's a very familiar surrounding in the private sector. And what I've come to learn is there are phenomenal management programs. There are terrific things that are there that are structured to help people through. But at the end of the day, the things that I've seen that have been working, or certainly have worked for me, have been men who courageously stood aside so that a chair was left open for me to take. And frankly, it's even more important for women to step aside so the next woman can take that chair. And I can see why it's hard, because if you're lucky enough to have the one chair, you really don't want to give it up. But you have to. And so there's a lot of the internal growth that needs to happen in recognizing that giving people space is not a zero-sum game. I mean, there's plenty of leadership to go around, and it's not about the title that's there. I'm here not because of a title, I'm here because there was something that I could contribute. And we all have something to contribute. And I think getting to a position where you can have that kind of voice, I will say, leaving the traditional public health space and coming into the business space, even though you know some of the currency I bring is my public health and economic skills, the real flip point for me was when I realized I didn't have to be the technical expert anymore. I'll say when I was in public health, traditional public health, I had to be the technical expert. In private sector, the more that you're getting comfort in leveraging a point of view and really connecting other people's technical skills to bring forward a point of view is what's respected. And figuring out how to listen well and reject at the right time. And so for me, that's what's been incredibly helpful in the private sector. And as I said, I'm currently in med tech. And we all know that the technology in general is a sector that is has a lot of growth in this area. It needs to have a lot of growth in this area. This is the first time that I've been told, and I agree, that I'm likely being watched by other younger women and other people in the company because there happens to be one that's there. And with that comes so much responsibility that I don't think I fully appreciated when I was in the throes of the HIV movement or in other parts of global health, because we were all helping other women do the things that we do. We were in the rooms very much like this one, and you just got some energy and comfort in the sisterhood that always was there. It's very different from a different perspective. But at the end of the day, I will say it's the male leader that's confident enough to step aside and coach through that has been the most helpful to me. So teaching them how to do that. And us how to do that for the next one is what I would like to
do. That's great. Thank you so much. So moving over to Leticia. In the U.S., only 5 of the top 20 schools of public health are led by female deans. However, the vast majority of the global health, the vast majority of the global health departments are chaired by male professors, despite the fact that staff and students are majority female. So you've been quite successful in academia. Globally, South Africa. Tell us a little bit about your secret. How can we really leverage academia to help advance the SDG agenda? And how might the situation have been different between South Africa and maybe some other global settings that you've been in?
I want to pick up on a couple of things that Christine and Purvi said. In that, I don't think we should fool ourselves that every woman leader is a gender activist. That's not the case. And in fact, sometimes younger people find it even more difficult to move up the hierarchy if there's a female leader. And it's a very lonely process, and so often you find that when somebody has sort of broken the proverbial glass ceiling, that they don't necessarily want, as you put it, don't want to give up, you know. So, but I would say I've been particularly conscious to try and grow the next generation of public health leaders. In fact, I think that that's how you leave your legacy. It's not by holding onto it, but by actually taking younger. So I think I've been quite successful with growing young academics. So to give you a specific example, I mean, I think the figures, South Africa, of course, is a much smaller country, but if we look at academia in South Africa, the sort of top-rated researchers with the highest age factors are white and male, and, you know, and aging. And so it can be a very tough environment, particularly for young black academics to stay in academia. And there's a huge debate in South Africa. And some of you might have seen some of the recent news flashes around the protests throughout campuses, university campuses in South Africa. So I've found that particular strategies, one is it around you have to develop some targeted programs. It's important to make people believe in themselves that they can do it. And it's a wonderful feeling when you see a young female emerging academic who has for the very first time their first author on a publication. And the joy is just, their joy is unbelievable, but I think often my joy is probably a lot greater than, you know, than theirs. And so it's around, you know, being very conscious of those issues. It's around very active support. It's around mentoring, a very sort of structured mentoring program, you know, that you need to embark on, and to realize that that in fact you got to where you are because somebody, an older person, was actually willing to invest in you and to give you a chance and to give you that first opportunity. And so many times I find that you don't necessarily have to tell the young person that they've made that it's been a flop, you know, if it's the very first time they do a presentation. But what I often do is I make them do dry runs before I let them loose into a public audience. Mm-hmm. And on many occasions they have to do it more than, you know, they have to pretend that I'm the audience, do more than one presentation. And again, you know, it always works, you know. So there's some very specific strategies that I think one can embark on to grow the next generation of public health academics.
Thank you so much. So moving down to Isabella. The recent 68th World Health Assembly of the World Health Organization, 23% of chief delegates of member state delegations were headed by women. It's a pretty low number. However, the World Health Organization is led by a woman, and PAHO, your region, is directed by two women at the top. So clearly something's going well. So tell us a little bit about PAHO's approach, maybe what's changed over the years, and how that's going to set you up to succeed with the SDGs.
So just to say a little bit more about where we're at, Margaret Chan is the Director General of WHO, Carissa Tian is the Director of PAHO. Executive management in both of those organizations, 50% are women, so 4 out of 8 in WHO and 2 out of 4 in PAHO, and that more women than men are regional directors of WHO offices as well. That doesn't mean we've gotten to where we want to be. We have, if you look at our sort of the leadership level, which is what we call P5 and above, so the unit chiefs, department director chiefs, PAHO is at about 42% women, and we are very conscious of that. We do monitor our gender statistics, and I think we have to do more. We haven't done enough, but we do think about how to bring women into to the organization. And I know WHO is doing the same thing. Just last night, I saw a memo from one of their meetings where they talked about gender parity, how they're not there, and some of the steps that they, and I'll get into that in a second, that we might be able to take to achieve gender parity in the sort of the decision levels. So I think on the technical side, I think we're doing well. I want to focus on two things that aren't going so well. So let's talk about that 23%. So if you break it down by regions, you find that there's a lot of heterogeneity. So in the Americas, as Nicole said, So I'm going to talk a little bit about the issue of heterogeneity. So with the 23%, if you break it down by region, the number of heads of delegation that are women in the Americas is 34%. In Europe is not far behind, I think it's around 30%. But if you look at Eastern Mediterranean, it's 10%. Mm-hmm. If you look at Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific, it's 15 to 20%. So I think, we talk about women's empowerment and gender equity sort of as one thing, but there's a lot of cultural and other issues that enter into the equation. And I think as we think about this on a global level, we need to be supporting women where they haven't been empowered, especially in areas where, you know, only 10% representation, or 15%. To me, that's something really important. We need to think about diversity, not just having women at the table at 50%, but having women from different cultures and different areas at the table and making sure that we're bringing all women up and, you know, not just women in the West, which is what it tends to be right now, I think. And that's true in the Americas as well. For PAHO,
for instance, we have, there's 42% of the professionals there are women. There's been every country in pretty much, I don't want to say every, but almost every country in the region has had at least one female minister in the minister of health in the last 15 to 20 years. But we're talking about the SDGs. Equity is a thread running through the SDGs, all kinds of equity and inequities. Latin America, the Caribbean, the Americas, because the U.S. is part of this, most inequitable region globally. So although on an average we have better outcomes, the benefits have accrued much more to the wealthy than they have to the vulnerable and the poor. And that's a big problem, and that's one thing the SDGs has to check. So if you, in the Americas, the populations that are particularly vulnerable are indigenous health, really not great outcomes, and in some countries they're from Caribbean populations. So we really need to monitor and work with women in those cultures and empower those women, because we're not going to make progress if we don't. And at PAHO, for instance, although we are developing an indigenous health strategy that we're going to be talking about, though, members, we don't have any indigenous women. We don't have any indigenous people working in our organization. So that is a problem. And it's sort of another layer in the discussion on leadership in women's health that I think that we do need to address. And I think the other one that I'm just going to bring it out, although it's not an SDG issue, is it's the political sphere, really. To me, at this point, in the U.S. and more broadly, where women are not represented is in the legislatures, the political legislatures, the parliaments. There just aren't enough women. And I think the barriers at this point to really do, because I think part of it is that the pool of women isn't as big as it should be. Women drop out. A lot of women drop out. You know, you have a child and you decide you just can't do it all and you're going to stay at home and there's no child care. Those are the issues that we need to tackle now. We've brought up in lots of books, Lean In, etc. But I don't think we're going to get anywhere if we don't have political representation in Congress, in the U.S., in legislatures, in the Americas, in parliaments, etc. So I am just going to put out a plug for that, too. We need to get women into politics. I don't blame them for not wanting to go. But I think part of the problem why we don't want to go is because there's an old boys club there, and that has to go away. We need women in politics, and that's going to help global health and women in health, I'm sure. So that's my only answer.
I think we all appreciate your last comment. And I would just add, especially in the White House, no bias. So closing out this section of the conversation, Alyssa, we talked about your network of student change makers working at community level with organizations. I think we've heard a lot about institutions, but let's bring it back to really working with communities and those organizations and communities. What kind of trends are you seeing? What's important? And I'd also add that 80% of your network are women. So what are you doing to recruit more men? Oh, sorry, you need my
microphone. Can you read it? Okay. Thanks, Nicole. So for some context, right now we have GloMed chapters at 56 universities, all of which are in the U.S., and there's about 1,500 students across those universities, and we also have about 1,500 alumni. We're 10 years old now. So we have a network of about 300 people who have been through the American university system in some capacity. And like Nicole was mentioning, about 80% of them, 75 to 80% are women. And we're a leadership development organization. Our goal is to develop the next generation of leaders for global health, or what we like to call 21st century leaders for global health. And I want to talk about two things, and then I'll try to answer the question about how to get men involved, but I think it actually conflicts with the goal of this panel. But so the first thing I want to talk about is this issue of how do we sustain ourselves through the work when maybe we're the only woman in the room, or when it's really hard to get that one chair? And I think if we look across the field of global health or public health, You see a majority of women in entry-level roles. You see a majority of women in undergraduate and maybe even graduate-level programs, but then you see a huge dropout rate. And if we also look across the NGO sector in particular, you see a lot of burnout, a lot of people reporting burnout. And so I want to call attention to that because it could be that people are actually getting too burnt out to get to the leadership levels or to even try to have the energy to try to get there. And so in GlobeMed, there's two things that we've always tried to focus on since the time we were founded that I think, I hope will help us try to break through that burnout culture that we find in the global health NGO space in particular. The first is community. I think that you see this room of amazing women, and it's likely that you may not know anybody else in here, and it's also likely that you may walk out of here not knowing anybody else still. And that's a shame, because we're going to need each other if we're going to be able to help each other fill those seats and start to open up more seats so that we don't have to compete for them. The second thing that we've tried to focus on a lot that I think is unique to our organization but shouldn't be is a focus on reflection and discernment as practices within an individual's growth, both professionally and personally. And so what that means in practice is that on a weekly basis, our chapters come together at their university. There's about 50 students per chapter, and we structure dialogue for them to facilitate on their own about how their personal identity influences the work that they want to do and the way that they want to do it, and specifically how that influences the way they're going to work together across disciplines within their own chapter, but then also across cultures, religions, races, etc. And those are two areas, building community and facilitating one's own self-growth, that don't get a lot of attention. You can't take a class on them necessarily, but they're essential if we're going to sustain ourselves through this really, really challenging, complex work. And the other piece I want to focus on is what many people have brought up about diversity. So if we're looking at, I think that we are seeing, I hope we're seeing some positive trends in terms of getting more women to the table, whatever that might mean, your own table in your workplace. But who are those women? Where are they coming from? How do they gain access to that table? And, you know, what's their socioeconomic status? What's their racial background? What neighborhood were they born into? Were they the first generation college student? These things all make a huge difference and can be seen as one's distance traveled. And if every woman at the table has a short distance traveled, or, you know, access was really just about, you know, it was closer, then that's not going to cut it, because that's not representative of the populations that the field seeks to serve. And so at GlobeMed, when I first started working full-time for the organization 4.5 years ago, our network was made up 100% of universities that were predominantly white institutions. And now we have about 20% of the universities that we work at that are minority-serving institutions, and that includes historically black colleges and universities and Hispanic-serving institutions. And that's essential because while it's harder for some students at minority-serving institutions to facilitate our programs because of a lack of resources or maybe a lack of a global health department that I had access to at GW, it's essential that we start to break through these barriers for people who are coming from a greater distance travel background. And so those are the two points I wanted to bring up as it relates to getting more men involved at undergraduate and entry level. I actually think it's going to require male leadership, because I think that male leadership at the youth level, because I think that people tend to attract people who are like them, for better or worse. And hopefully we can break through that, but until then, we see that across our chapters that those chapters that have male co-presidents have more males within their chapters. So unfortunately, maybe that doesn't really align well here, but I also think, just really quickly on that point, if we are able to get more men into undergraduate programs, graduate programs, and entry-level positions. For me personally, that's where my values orientation has come from, these curricula and training programs at these younger ages. And so if more men can be a part of that now, then hopefully they'll become the men who will open up the seat for other women or create more seats.
Great answer. Wonderful, thank you. So we're going to turn to audience question and answer now to allow for another, since we've got a packed room, I hope there's going to be lots of questions for our panel. So we have, I think I'm holding a mic, so I can hand over to, so if you want to raise your hand and just say your name, your organization, and then give your question.
Hi, my name is Janice Springer, and I'm a public health nurse, and I work in the domestic U.S. and the international world in disaster nursing. And there are 16 million nurses on this planet, and most of them are women. And if you're looking for a group of people who have an enormous potential to help us change the conversations in our countries, I'd say look there. It's a resource for you. There's a group called the International Council of Nurses. Those ladies are rock stars. And you want to get to know them. They're quite a group. So it's my pleasure to be part of that community.
Does anybody on the panel want to comment on nurses?
Why don't we take a few?
Why don't we take a few? Okay.
Sure.
Hi, my name's Ashley, and I'm an MPH student at Tulane University. My question, just talking about in politics or in any sort of organization, bringing more women to leadership or to the Senate or the House or whatever, do you think that it's appropriate to set quotas, or do you think that that affects women? Like, how does that affect women? Does it create a stigma? Like, what do you think about the idea of setting quotas for bringing women to the table?
Maybe one more question?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Temi Ifeforiu of the Public Health Institute, embedded at USAID. I guess my question has to do with all of the panelists. Underlying what you've talked about is a social justice theme. You know, talking about really ending injustice in our lifetime, ending discrimination in our lifetime. You're all kind of in positions where you get to be gatekeepers. So how have you been able to negotiate or maneuver conversations about social justice, injustice, and discrimination are not popular terms and don't always resonate with everybody. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you address that.
Great. So should we start with the last question on social justice? Does any of the panelists want to start with that one? It's an easy one.
Okay, so I'm just going to also bring home the realities of all of us as working women, that we're also managing our families and our kids, and that was, I did it again. It was the alarm for me to check in with my son about his homework. So, you know, we're all juggling a lot of things. But to go to, thank you for the comment on nurses, and we actually work very closely with the Frontline Health Workers Coalition and nurses and midwives, and so, you know, yes, I agree, they are rock stars, and we will try to optimize our relationship with them. On quotas, I think that what we have seen, and this is, yes, I think there should be quotas. Some of that is my personal opinion, but a lot of that is very much backed up by evidence and research. I don't know if you want to call it quotas, if you want to call it affirmative action, if you want to call it, you know, setting policy about how many people will be represented in a particular government or legislative setting. But what we have seen is that when that happens, we do see a balance of power, a balance, and it comes down to power. It is not just sitting in a room. It is also sitting in a room where the decisions are being made. What we also know, and I think, you were talking about this with men, but what we know is that, you know, if you're one or two women in a room where decisions are being made, it is much harder for you to speak out. When you are surrounded by other women and there is a gender equity in that setting, it is much easier for everyone, well, I don't know about the men, but for the women to be able to express themselves and to participate in molding the discussion, molding the policies, and making the decisions. I think one of the really interesting questions around quotas or affirmative action is, you know, how long do we have to keep that in place? Once you have achieved it, do you then say, okay, the battle is won, we can back off now? What we have seen with affirmative action in higher education is that, in fact, that is absolutely not the case. If you take away affirmative action at universities, they go right back to previous practices. So we need to have really well thought out, concrete mechanisms that actually level the playing field. And, you know, whatever we call them, they need to be there. And I would say Rwanda is a really interesting example of where this has been done very successfully in their parliament and is continuing. But again, you know, I think that kind of mechanism is necessary. For social justice, so again, I love my job. One of the best things about my job is if I say, you know, we really need to be talking about this more, like, I can kind of make that happen. And, you know, Rupa and I met at a conference and we said, we need to be talking about this more. And here we are today and we're having this panel and we're launching an initiative in a couple of weeks and you can make things happen. And you can also, I think, and this goes to this idea of leadership, whether it's women's leadership or any leadership, there are topics that people don't like to discuss. There are topics that people don't like to acknowledge. And I think one of the roles of a real leader and a challenge of a real leader is to be able to introduce things that people don't like to discuss, that make people uncomfortable, and say, you know, acknowledge it makes people uncomfortable. But once we've acknowledged that, we've gotten that out into the room, then we say, okay, but it is a reality and we have to take that forward. And I mean, I was thinking about you having, you know, condom discussions with your parents, you know. They don't want to be having that discussion. But you know, you need to be able to get that out into the space. You need to be leading that discussion. And when people see you standing up and saying, we have to acknowledge this, we have to take this forward, that, again, gives more room for others to take part, for others to speak up, and for others to help move that forward. Thanks.
Yeah, just a little bit. So, a couple of things. I think we should acknowledge that there is something unique about global health and the way we work in global health that I believe is a bit, that makes the incline on the hill a little steeper, especially if you're in global health, maybe more so than domestic. I can't say it because I've always spent my time globally. But we're in a field that is requiring us to be on the move. And that adds a different level of challenge, and I think during a women's life course, there are moments and checkpoints where we make decisions about our lives, whether it's being a working mother or a working daughter. I happen to be a working daughter. And that is something that we have to factor in. And so one of the things that was raised earlier about the talent pool, and as you move along, that pool gets shallower and shallower because people are dropping out, whether it's burnout or life choices. We're trying to look at the very top and we're seeing, well, no one's there. It's because that pipeline has leaks in it all over. And it's not because something's gone wrong, it's because we're living our lives. And we are people that take care of people. That's probably why we're in public health in the first place. So there is something that likely needs to be disrupted about how we do our work. I don't know what the solution to that is, but I think there's some creative space in a time of disruptive innovation for us to think about how the public health workplace comes together. Because it's not coming together today to serve women in the traditional life journey that I think many of us take. So just wanted to put that out there because working mothers, working daughters are out there and they may need a different cadence On the topic of quotas, which kind of goes to social justice, you know, the times that have been creative for me, so one, I believe you need to call out the elephant in the room, whether that's a quota or not. It needs to be called out, it needs to be stated, it needs to be acted upon, it needs to be measured in some way. Depending on who you work for and how that goes, there's all sorts of issues around that. So that's my answer. But I think at the end of the day, it needs to be called out. And part of the private sector question that I was asked before that I didn't really get to is there are all sorts of internal structures which exist in most of our organizations that are created to bring people, whether they're women, whether they're people of color, whether it's you know, issues around gender equality, within a workplace as employees to start to address these issues. So an important step is to join them. It's part of the original point of being in a community is required in order to start to change some of those injustices. The final
definitely. I think the few times I've had to speak up, especially when you're in the corporate sector that's trying to be very responsible and cares a good bit about their own reputation externally in the world, is to reflect as things are coming together that something doesn't feel right. So I've certainly spoken up when an all-male panel was put together because I had a responsibility to. It wouldn't take care of itself on its own. But the tactic that I took to solve that injustice was to say, well, is this really the face of the company that we want to show? And putting the question back, recognizing that of course it's not, quickly resolves it, right? And so there are ways of addressing the injustice by posing the question back to those that are making the decision. But what it takes is saying something, because it doesn't take care of itself on its own. And it can be one of those challenging issues that needs to be addressed. So it's back to not being the one-third of girls not even speaking up in the room then. We have to say something.
Hi, I'm not sure if the intention is for all of us to comment, but let me talk to the issue of social justice. I think it's a combination of issues. In my school, we stated explicitly on our website that one of our principles is about equity and social justice. Mm-hmm. We also teach it both a separate course that's called Health and Society, but it's also a sort of cross-cutting issue as part of what we call critical pedagogy. And then I think another important aspect is being a role model. You know, you need to actually walk the talk and not just talk about social justice, but then often in actions and behavior you might show something else. On the issue of quotas, South Africa, I mean, you talk about Rwanda, but I mean, I think the other example is in South Africa where there's very explicit legislation about redress. So we have what's called an Employment Equity Act. And the idea of the act is to recognize the injustices of the past and to focus particular attention to women, disabled individuals, and, you know, black people, and, you know, in general. It's interesting because some recent work that's been, so it would be women of all races, some recent work that's been done has shown that the women that have benefited most are white women and women of Indian descent. And so there's some other debates and questions now about how do you actually make sure that black women, also benefit. So in Parliament, we have very good representation of the majority party in Parliament. I think, though, it's again, I want to make the point that it's not every woman that's a gender activist, you know, and that's necessarily aware of these issues around gender. So I think you need, when you put women in positions of power, I think we need support, and I also think there's space for to teach some of those aspects of critical reflection and, you know, and capacity building. So, for example, how do you deal with sometimes nasty comments from male colleagues? You know, they just to give you a very specific example, I often find it very interesting when it's a female politician, then the criticism becomes very very personal. It's about what they wear, you know, it's about how they look, whether they're overweight, you know, whether the dress fits well at the opening of Parliament. But you'll never find that those issues are discussed in relation to male politicians. And so, you know, so it's around those kind of, like, nasty bits, you know, that come with being in position of power that I think we also have to be aware of, and which can be particularly hurtful to women. And then just lastly, the comment about politics. To my colleague, you know, I'm a nurse, and, you know, I'm aware of the ICN. We've done some work in South Africa recently, which actually shows one of the things that you have to get into that murky, dirty word of politics. And many nurses are not, our training doesn't prepare us to kind of get into navigating what I call political minefields. And our own research has actually found that although democracy has opened the space for women, for nurses in particular, you know, to be able to occupy quite senior leadership positions, there's a lot of contestation. And when it comes to our medical colleagues, sometimes the actual greatest degree of contestation is actually with female doctors, you know, and how they I have particular theories around it, which I'm very happy to discuss with you outside. But I think nurses face those issues. If they're black nurses, they face issues of race, you know, of gender in relation to male medical colleagues, and class, you know, class issues and position in the health hierarchy.
Do you want to?
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm from the University of Michigan School of Public Health. I'm an MPH student. And I was just wondering if you guys could kind of speak to maybe the challenges and then potential solutions that you've experienced working within cultural and societal structures, specifically abroad, where men don't respect you. I know that that does happen domestically, but maybe it's more prominent in other countries that you've worked in, and how you kind of work within those structures, because those can't change overnight. Necessarily, I've had faculty have talked about how they've had to have a male colleague with them in order to get any of their voice heard, and just kind of how you've navigated those structures and those struggles, because that can be kind of hard to take probably at times. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So you will take three questions.
Thank you all for sharing your experiences. My name is Nia B. Shah. I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm also at Public Health Institute, and ironically, my job is as a gender advisor in public health, which is great, but I also really related to, I think, Ruby, you had said, you know, this mandate to be the technical advisor, which I'm not considered a technical advisor. So working with my technical colleagues can be very challenging at times. But what I really want to come back to, and I've heard a number of you talk about this either directly or indirectly and through the audience as well, is I think that in order to reach these goals, we really are at a point where we need to transform gender norms. And I think the only way we're going to be able to do it is if we constructively engage men and boys as supporters and also as change agents themselves. So I'd really love to see this movement and this coalition really embrace that in a way that still has a safe space for women and our gap that we have in order to get to that level playing field. But at the same time, if we want to reach sustainable achievement, not only in these goals but in gender equality, I think we really need to find a way to work together in a way that's going to change these things, because everything that we've talked about, from quotas to disparities in the workplace, are really rooted in these inequalities. So would love to hear your more thoughts on that.
Hi, my name is Dr. Antonde. I'm faculty at the University of Calabar in Nigeria. And my question is to the first panelist over here. You talk about working out there in Rwanda and having all the student coalitions that you are preparing for global health work. What are you doing in relation to collaborations with students of the schools of public health that are resident or that are from that country? Because you will always go in and come out. But what's going on with forming these relationships with students of public health who are there?
Can I start?
Sure. Thank you. Well, so right now and for the past 10 years, the way that all of our programs work is that each university works with a local organization that's founded and led by people from that community who are guiding the strategy and the work of the partnership. But for the first time this year, we're opening up our chapter application for students from anywhere in the world, and we're going through strategic planning right now. And it's likely that we'll have a goal of broadening our network beyond U.S. universities for the next 5 to 10 years. We see that there's more. When we were started back in 2007, there were very few programs for American undergraduate students in global health, which is hard to believe now. But now you have a lot of programs that cater to American students and very few that are supporting students abroad. And so we're recognizing that, and we'll hopefully have more to follow up on that in a year, or hopefully less. I also wanted to comment briefly on the two other questions about social justice and the quotas. So first, GloMed is a social justice organization and always has been, and we use global health as a lens through which people can begin to understand social justice. And so there's two things that I wanted to comment on related to that. A couple years ago, we created an anti-oppression statement, and that was really, really important for us for a number of reasons. One, because it aligned our team and our network around what do we mean when we talk about social justice, and what we mean is really anti-oppression, and making sure that we're not an organization that's talking about doing good work abroad while perpetuating injustices in the U.S. And so I would say write it down, what you mean, put it on the website if your institution is flexible and willing enough to do that, and circulate it. And then two, show what you mean through about social justice through stories, because it can be hard to talk about broad terms unless you ground it. And related to the quotas, we don't call it quotas, but as a component of our anti-oppression statement, we've made a commitment to increasing access to all of our programming. And as a result of that, about 40% of our budget goes toward grants for either students or our grassroots partners to attend our programs. And within those grants, specifically the ones for students, we do give priority. We have this complex algorithm that looks at both socioeconomic capacity, racial and gender indicators, and then also the quality of their application and their involvement in the organization. And so I would say put a lot of time and thought into how you're actually quantifying what you want to see in the field, and then start at home. And if you can't figure out how to develop that algorithm, you can find pro bono consultants to do it like we did. And it's worth it. It's worked for us, at least. We've increased the diversity of the program on almost all metrics besides gender, which is still majority female, but all other metrics by over 100% in about 4 years.
Isabella, do you want to comment on any of the
questions? Maybe try and comment or try and tackle the question on challenges related to working abroad. So I've been fortunate in that when I've worked abroad, I've always had a big organization behind me. You know, CDC, I worked at CDC for 20 years, and Pan American Health Organization. And that's very, obviously very helpful, because then it's not just you, a woman, it's you representing this organization, which has a certain amount of power and respect per se. So that is helpful. But I'm also not saying that I've never been in a situation where it's been more somebody raised this here, where you're at the table and people just aren't. They're just not listening. They don't care. They don't want to hear you. And, you know, I think it's good to bring more than just yourself to the table. If there's a particular issue that you want to be sure is going to be heard, if you're the only one, it might be hard. But if there's more voices, then it's hard to ignore what you're trying to say. So that's one way to go. I think if it's real disrespect, then I think there was one case, and again, it was sort of more ignoring. And you can also complain. You can complain to supervisors and just, not acceptable, and I'm here to do something, and this is just not acceptable to me. And so in some cultures you can do that, but there are some cultures where you can't. I've never worked in the Middle East. I think that would be a particularly hard culture to work in. I worked in Pakistan, which actually was funny. There's a lot of very high-level women in institutions there, but I'm going to guess that working in the Middle East could be really, really hard. So I do not have that experience. So, you know, it's a little bit of individualizing, but those are some of the strategies that I use. I think on the issue of engaging men and boys, I absolutely agree with you, and I think that in this day and age, when we think about trying to change workplace policies, it really has to be about everybody. And it's, I don't think it's going to work if it's just about women. Men have to be involved. There have to be cultural, normative changes for men in the home, in the workplace, and in the long term, that's the only thing that's really going to make a difference. So I think we all need to be thinking. And I don't know, my sense is from young people, that men aren't changing. Am I, like, being a Pollyanna here? Are men changing? My nephew just had a baby. We'll see what happens. He's totally gaga over this little baby, and he's taking time off from work, and he's being allowed to take time off from work. But anyway, I hope that carries on, but I will see. That'll be my first sort of personal test on how much men are involved at home in this day and age.
Thank you. So we're out of time, but I wanted to offer if there was a burning comment from the other side of the panel where we can...
I would say, if I had to give a bit of advice, don't underestimate the amount of work that you need to put in as a woman. What I always say to those people that I mentor, there are various stereotypes about women, about our whether we're competent, whether we can really do the job, whether it was an affirmative action appointment. So what I always say to people, to young women in particular that I mentor, as well as to young black men, is don't allow the stereotypes that people have in your head, don't make sure that you don't confirm a stereotype that people have of you in their head. So that means that you have to work hard, you have to kind of keep your word. So if you say you're going to do something, make sure that you do that, and always be very prepared, you know, for a meeting, and kind of try and anticipate the worst and hope for the best.
I don't have much additional to offer because I think that pretty much says it all. The only thing that I can add is one strategy that has worked for me overseas as well as here. So when a conversation or a meeting is going in a direction where one's being ignored or disrespected, it's just close the notebook and say, I think maybe we need to do this in a way. I think half of it is it's unawareness, and then the minute it becomes aware, things do shift and change. But it does, again, it's back to all of these things. It's the courage from within to do the thing that needs to happen and to do all of the things that are hyper-professional for the reasons that we need to be.
And I will just add, don't internalize it. You will be told that you're not good enough. You will be told that you dropped the ball. You will be ignored in meetings. It isn't about you. And there will always be this voice in your head saying, oh, I wasn't good enough. I wasn't smart enough. I didn't say the right thing. I didn't do the right thing. I don't have a place at this table. And you do, until really proven otherwise. You do. And so, you know, at the end of the day, don't accept that you are less than the other people around you. But to reiterate what my colleagues and sisters have said here, you're going to have to do twice as much and prove yourself every day. But at the end of the day, it's worth it.
Thank you. Everybody, do you want to give any final remarks to close us out? Or?
I was just going to say that thank you for joining us for this conversation. This is just getting started. We're just dissecting. So it's great to hear all the audience participation. Please continue to follow us virtually as well as if you can join us for the official launch of the Women Leaders Global Health Initiative. It's going to be happening at the Global Health Council Landscape Symposium in Washington, D.C., November 19th. So thank you, everyone, and we really look forward to having this dialogue for the years to come.
Great.